Welcome to Future Horizons, the Tempest podcast. I'm your host, Sevi Watmo. In February 2024, Team Tempest published the Future Combat Air System Sustainability Strategy, which outlined the changes needed to drive a more sustainable and resilient future for the programme. The next generation of talent that is already working on Tempest is passionate about sustainability, and this strategy represents the start of a journey to position FCAS as a successful example of the UK defence industry's ability to produce a highly sustainable capability. In this episode, we discuss how Team Tempest will address the challenge, touching on some of the potential criticisms industry partners could face by prioritising sustainability. Joining us now are Alice Elliott, Rolls-Royce Sustainability Lead, Andy Eady, Rolls-Royce Sustainability Executive for Future Programmes, Group Captain Jamie Miller, Ministry of Defence, Head of Capability and Climate Security, and Andrew Sweeney, RAF Sustainable Aviation Strategy Lead. Andy Eady, coming to you first, this was very much an MOD-FCAS collaboration, really, wasn't it, to create this document?
Absolutely, yeah. So you could almost see it as a continuation of a lot of the good work that the MOD have been doing in the sustainability space. So a couple of years ago, a really influential document came out from the MOD, which was the Climate Change Sustainability Strategic Approach. And that really set the scene for what the topic meant for the MOD, both in terms of operations, support, and all of the advantages it could bring to the wider defence enterprise. More recently, we saw from Mr. Sweeney things like the Defence Aviation Net Zero Strategy that really started to zoom into aviation from a sectoral approach. And we can almost see the FCAS Sustainability Strategy being a continuation from that. We're starting to zoom into a particular programme, in this instance FCAS, and trying to explore how can we make it more resilient to things like the effects of climate change and extreme weather, which we're going to see a lot more happening in the future. Also how we can start to mitigate the risk associated with the supply of things like critical raw minerals and materials. But then also we can zoom into things like how can a programme like FCAS benefit society? How can it contribute to society's well-being and success? There's a really ambitious decarbonisation approach at the core of the strategy, which signs the programme up to achieving net zero emissions across scope 1, 2, and free at the point the platform enters service. And then also we're looking at how can the programme align to things like the National Value Framework. So,
what is the National Value Framework, Andy?
It was published in the Combat Air Strategy. So it's sort of aligning with things like levelling up agenda and then also things like the UK's ambition to build back better. That sort of thing.
So there's so many different areas that this covers. Andrew Sweeney, coming to you as RAF Sustainable Aviation Strategy Lead, why does this document really represent a real first?
I think this is really exciting because although, as kind of Andy Eady's alluded to, there's been some really good progress by the MOD for its sectoral approach, looking at its scope 1 and 2 emissions and how climate change is going to impact how we operate. Particularly focusing around the in-service phase of a lot of our capabilities. This is really the first time that we've started to look at this from the initial concept development of a new capability coming into service. And that's really important because it gives some real opportunities for how we can get after some of this more effectively, because there's only so much you can do to retrofit sustainability later down that part of the life cycle. So, for example, if you start looking at how you can design in the use of more energy secure fuels, for example, that has a load of operational benefits. How we look at like shortening the supply chain and the logistics required to keep that platform in service. And as Andy alluded to, some of the materials and the availability and the resilience in the supply chain of those not only offer the ability to improve our sustainability credentials, but they also significant opportunity to enhance the capability that we're bringing into service by tackling it really early in that kind of sustainable by design phase, which I think is a really exciting opportunity.
Jamie, Andrew has gone through the benefits of building sustainability right at the beginning, at the concept phase. Why do you think MOD leadership is particularly important in this area?
Well, again, thanks for inviting me. Well, this, the whole strategy is a first for such a large programme. And from my perspective and MOD perspective, it absolutely demonstrates leadership, not only across the UK, but globally, that, that we're thinking of sustainability at the beginning of such a large programme. And that sustainability really links in to the key enabler of operational advantage and resilience. And I think all three are connected. It one supports the other. So, from our perspective, as I say, it really shows leadership. And it's great to see industry, really being on board with the MOD at the beginning of this journey.
Alice, as sustainability lead at Rolls-Royce, have you found that there's been a bit of a challenge in terms of building sustainability into defence technology, in that there can be a level of cynicism in the responses you get to that, and how do you choose to respond to that?
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's a great point, and the defence industry is well known to be a large emitter. There's no really getting away from that. So if we're making commitments, then we've got to make the changes to meet these and use it more as an opportunity. And if we want to avoid any greenwashing, then we've got to demonstrate that we're consciously trying to do things differently than we've done in the past. So as a defence industry, like all industries really, we're also being challenged through sort of policies and regulations and targets as well. So there's a lot of challenges there, but there's a lot of areas of opportunities as well. That's how I would say it.
And everything happens in a sort of ecosystem, whether you're talking about industry or the MOD. And Andrew, coming to you, how are the Air Force and the MOD moving forward in a collaborative way, not just in terms of the technological side of things, but in terms of laying the groundwork to attract diverse future talent as well?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think since the release of the MOD's Climate Change Sustainability Strategic Approach a few years ago, and we started to talk about this more as a collective, I think the most impressive kind of response to that has been that kind of team collaborative effort between all of the defence sector. So by that, I mean broad across government, equipment providers, academia. And what we have to what we've all openly recognised here is a lot of the risks that come with climate change and sustainability to the defence sector are going to be very universally felt. So that kind of non-partisan collaborative effort is merely where we can start to get after those and make sure we're very clear about how we bring those along with us that want us to see us do more, and how also those who think this is a bit of a distraction for defence, why it's still absolutely essential because of the opportunity presents for things such as operational advantage. But drilling in specifically to one of the risks, which, as you alluded to, is we know that the workforce that's going to be entering into a lot of the defence sector over the next few years, they're very sympathetic and find the climate change and climate emergency really important, and they want to see an employer that is taking that seriously. And that's a risk that's going to be felt by industry, by the RAF and the MOD and academia alike. So the fact that we're all having this kind of collaborative, unified approach means that we're showing them that it's not just a one-off, it's something that we're all kind of striving to achieve.
There's been a lot of interest in sustainable aviation fuel, and it seems to have a lot of potential. How do you think we can ensure it's not just seen as a short-term measure? And do you feel that it's a lot more complex than that? It's not just a case of implementing ways of using sustainable aviation fuel?
Yes, SAF's a really interesting topic. And just by the nature of the fact that it's the question is kind of alluding to that, and not just all the other available options to aviation, shows how much focus comes on SAF. So I think the first instance is just looking at this FCAS programme itself. So noting this capability is going to come into service in the middle to the back end of the next decade. There aren't other propulsion technologies available that would allow us to put a combat air system that would allow it to meet its kind of power and thrust requirements. So we know that that platform is going to come into service using hydrocarbons. So if that's from more sustainable feedstocks, then that's definitely a positive. But noting that platform is going to be in until the end of this century, that shows that sustainable aviation fuels are here for the long term. It's not something that's going to be just a short term kind of fad and then it's going to go away. That platform is going to be locked in for many decades to come. And that reads across very well into civil aviation as well, albeit the more novel propulsion such as battery electric or hydrogen might be suitable for certain ranges and applications. For things such as multi-aisle, long-range aircraft, again, hydrocarbons are still going to be part of that factor for a long time. So SAF is absolutely critical to how we look at making the sector more sustainable. And noting that that is going to be a factor for civil as well. The other part that is a really crucial to defence is what we've benefited over the whole existence of aviation is we've been completely interoperable with civil aviation in terms of the fuels that we use. So certainly in my time when I was working on helicopters, when we deployed out to an operational theatre, we could seamlessly drop into any civilian airport and take the fuel that they used before we then went on to the next phase of where we were operating. If we were to, say, see sustainability as a bit of a distraction and kind of stand still and kind of carry on using the fuels that we already use now in fossil fuels, what we might find is that we're then unable or constrained in the kind of airfields that we could drop into, and that would significantly reduce our operational effectiveness. So it's absolutely critical that the MOD and the Air Force remains on that SAF journey with all the other aviation stakeholders that are involved. The one other thing which I would think is really important with SAF, though, and has to be mentioned, is the volumes of SAF that we have available now are really, really small, and it is going to take time for that to scale up as we see investment and resource put into that technology. And actually, in the short to medium term, the biggest impact that a lot of our suppliers can do is looking at ways that we can make our capabilities more efficient and reduce our dependency on fuel, so the SAF that we do have available has an even greater impact. So there's quite a lot of unpacked there, but SAF is definitely here for the long term, and it's going to be an absolute key part of how we make the sector more sustainable.
Jamie, from what Andrew's described, it looks like it will take time to build SAF fuel into operations. From an MOD perspective, how are they reflecting and looking at this in terms of strategy going into the future?
Yeah, well, last year, or the end of last year, we launched the Defence Operational Energy Strategy, which is looked after by the Operational Energy Authority. And that strategy really was to start our thinking regarding what was seen as fuel in the past, and as Andy alluded to, aviation fuel and diesel, to new energy sources, which will become prevalent in the UK battle space. And that can be anything from, you know, solar, wind, ESAF, to power electric type vehicles or UAVs, etc. So we've got to look at how we can transition in an orderly fashion, and at what point defence will have to make absolutely key decisions for future pieces of equipment. And that's not only reference sustainability, but it's that piece, as Andrew mentioned, being able to connect with not only the civilian space, but our allies as well. And I think that really is the key. It's that interoperability piece, be that internally or actually, as I say, with our allies and be able to move anywhere in the world. So I think it's going to be much more complex with energy before it simplifies. I think we'll go through a transition, as will the world, in fact, before we come to settle on, you know, certain types of energy forms in the longer term.
Andy, can you bring us up to speed with some of the SAF trials that have been going on in Rolls-Royce? I understand they're more for the civilian market, but if you can describe how they've been effective in demonstrating how it can be used.
Yeah, absolutely. So Rolls-Royce have done a lot of trials with sustainable aviation fuels. So you might have seen in the news towards the end of last year, we recently ran our UltraFan civil engine demonstrator on a 100% SAF, and that subsequently confirmed compatibility across all of our in-production civil engine types. There were defence examples as well. So last year, we also supported the 100% SAF flight of the RAF Voyager, which was really exciting. So we've got plenty going on in this space.
I think that, Jamie, how do you feel that sustainability can contribute to achieving the operational advantage that you were describing earlier, that sense of boosting resilience? Because it begins, I suppose, as a more general strategy, but you have to be part of a team that are looking into the specifics and actually building from the ground up.
That's a huge question, but and I could use many examples, but if I just take one, I think, to try and bring some of these points together. You know, for operational advantage and resilience, you know, we could look at additive manufacturing, especially in the deployed environment. You know, being able to deploy with less spares, knowing that we can produce those spares on demand out in a theatre, you know, not only ensures that, you know, those aircrafts are not sat on the ground waiting for a spare to come potentially from the UK, and that therefore they're operationally ready, but also we've got a potential there to reduce the demand on a supply chain. And then supply chains straight away, you know, another two simple examples of where we save there. Supply chains are vulnerable, as we've seen in recent and ongoing conflicts. So reducing the number of aircraft spares shipped is a positive. But secondly, again, it goes to that operational advantage. If we have to transport less spares, then that gives us or gives the operational commander an option to transport other key equipment, or potentially reduce the number of flights or freight movements. Again, great sustainability advantage. So in that one example, you know, we've just seen how you've got operational advantage improved, resilience improved, and taking Tempest at say this early stage of development, you know, looking at the supply chain, the repair chain, that cradle to grave view. It's just obvious that with, you know, a slightly different mindset, there is so much that can be achieved. Operational advantage, resilience, potential cost savings, as well as, you know, reducing those environmental impacts.
Alice, from an industrial perspective, can you share how Rolls-Royce is looking to boost resilience?
Yeah, of course. So sort of touching on what Jamie's just said there, resilience covers that huge range of topics and applies throughout the life cycle of a product. So if you're thinking of it within Rolls-Royce from a design perspective, you can help build that resilience and sustainability in right from the concept stage and how you make the decisions. So design engineers are already probably making decisions around resilience when they're thinking about material choices, and that will, as a bonus, have a sustainability advantage too. So considering the material choices we're using for the engine will help from a sustainability benefit as well as resilience. The two go hand in hand really nicely. So yeah, just changing that mindset piece and introducing more of a change program into the way we do things for FCAS is going to be fundamental in incorporating both that sustainability and resilience thread.
Yeah, the importance of the mindset in sustainability always seems to come to the fore, and we hear a lot about the circular economy mindset. Andy, can you help us understand, first of all, what a circular economy mindset is and how you're applying it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really cool topic. So the majority of the current world around us is basically what we call the linear economy. So essentially we make and we waste. We're pulling material out of the ground, we're making something, we're using it, and then ultimately, at the end of the day, we're chucking it away. And an obvious consequence of that model is landfill. What a circular economy approach or mindset lets us do is it attempts to close that loop between take and waste, with an ambition to remove waste altogether, essentially taking us from that take, make, waste model to a reduce, reuse, recycle model. A great example of this that is normally used in the sort of aviation example is things like cooking oils. So otherwise they're destined to sort of clog somebody's drain if you chuck it away, but actually can we take that as somebody's waste and use that to produce biofuels for an aircraft? Or another example that we sometimes talk about is with batteries or high performance aerospace batteries. Could we give that a second life on a different platform or application? So I think the obvious benefits of adopting a circular economy mindset are linking back into that resilience piece. There's an obvious environmental benefit, avoiding that straight to landfill model that we saw earlier. And one of the ways that we're applying this on the programme, we've got this really exciting project going on called Tornado to Tempest, which is in collaboration with the MOD. And essentially what we're doing is we're taking a tornado component, so it's going to be a titanium fan blade, and we're going to clean it up a little bit, atomise it, so turn it into a metal powder, and then use that metal powder as feedstock to 3D print a part that is going to be representative of a Tempest part. So you can immediately start to think of all the stock that's held in warehouses that can live a new life, recycled on a more sustainable Tempest platform. And then on top of that, there's the whole world of digital, which really enables a lot of the stuff that we're talking about on this podcast episode. So in this instance, we're looking at things like digital product passports, really cool emerging bit of technology that might provide a more automated approach to gathering sustainability data through a product's lifecycle. So we're hoping to demonstrate that as part of Tornado to Tempest and understand how feasible it might be to scale it across a program like FCAS and ensure that we're able to meet our decarbonisation commitments across the supply chain. So yeah, all really cool stuff.
And, you know, some of the techniques you've described are quite exciting. And Alice, I'm imagining that you're going to have to prepare employees for this step change. How are you building the mindset piece into your plans for employees upskilling in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the pilot projects that Andy sort of alluded to there are going to be fundamental in that, because it will demonstrate the benefits that there will be through sort of implementing sustainability and doing things differently. And it'll also maybe inspire those who are maybe perhaps more cynical in the space as well. So demonstrating that, demonstrating the advantages, it means that we can embrace circular economy throughout FCAS and maybe change the mindsets of everyone that we're working with. So it's going to be a huge change programme to sort of cover the whole of the FCAS programme. But it's something that we're working to do through training, through sort of giving examples of really good best practices to inspire people, also improving some of our comms and engagement. This podcast is a great example of that. Also, can we put out newsletters, anything like that, good news stories to inspire people, training there to give people the skills behind it. And all of these will add up to hopefully create that sort of seismic shift in the way we do things traditionally, that we can see more of those advantages.
Jamie, if all of these new techniques are brought into play, there's going to be a real cost benefit, isn't there?
Well, I think as Andy just demonstrated with the idea of using older spares or spares that are in warehouse that aren't required anymore, you know, I think it's amazing that we're starting to even look, at the end of the life of a piece of equipment that hasn't even come into service yet. But that's the way we should be looking at it, to make sure our balance of investment, we're looking at these initiatives, look at that really long term, especially, as we move forward, to the end of this century, the reuse of precious metals, critical metals, mineral availability, will probably be less. So all of a sudden, everything we're using today could have an exponential value, a much greater value, at the end of the century. So it's getting into that mindset, which, for MOD could be a huge win-win, that actually you've got something usable at the end of a life cycle as well.
Andrew, looking at things from an RAF perspective, can you help everyone understand how a circular economy could really unlock the operational advantage?
Yeah, I think it's always important when we talk about a lot of the sustainability concepts or technologies, is it's also really important to try and make clear how they can boil down to operational effectiveness. And the circular economy is absolutely no different in that respect. So if you think of any deployed operational environment, the risk that the military holds with that is trying to get equipment or spares or other material in to that deployed theatre, as well as getting waste out of it. And if there's any opportunity there where you can minimise that waste or put that waste back into reducing the burden of logistics supply that you have to get in, then that's only going to be of benefit in terms of people's lives, in terms of cost, in terms of opportunity to enhance the capability that you have being deployed there. So, I think things such as circular economy, it's always important to try and make that connection to how they can offer that benefit as well. And that's absolutely the case.
So many fascinating things to talk about today. And I'm sure, no doubt, we could go on for much longer. But thank you very much, Andy, Alice, Jamie and Andrew, for discussing this today.
Join us again for the next episode of Future Horizons, the Tempest podcast.